This is your brain on risk. This is Mind Over Money, the podcast where Kevin Cook exposes the psychology of investing.
Welcome back to Mind Over Money. I'm Kevin Cook, your field guide and storyteller for the fascinating arena of behavioral economics. Last week, I made a video presentation called Gaming the Stock Market with Poker Smarts, where I drew some very important connections between the behavioral analysis of poker champ Daniel Negreanu and the work that I do in playing stocks. If you missed that video, there will be a link to it in the article that accompanies this podcast. Or just hit me up on Twitter, at Kevin B. Cook, and I'll make sure you get the link. I wanted to follow up this week with an expanded discussion on the topic. And then something happened over the weekend that made me more certain about what angle to take. The legendary game show host Monty Hall of Let's Make a Deal fame passed away at the ripe young age of 96. Monty's fun and laughs with his infamous three doors with prizes is a fantastic probability brain buster that I learned to dissect from one of the great market wizards in Jack Schwager's book. We'll learn more about that in a moment. Before I dive into today's episode, though, I want to be thoughtful and respectful with regard to one of the U.S. kingdoms where this gambling math reigns, Las Vegas, Nevada. Just 2 days ago, on Sunday, October 1st, at around 10 p.m. Las Vegas time, a twisted coward opened fire with several assault weapons on a large concert crowd by the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino. At this time, nearly 60 people have lost their lives and hundreds more are injured, with dozens still fighting for their lives. While there will be endless media coverage all week, all any of us really need to do is just imagine the horror of watching one of your friends or loved ones die in your arms. It makes you want to be really quiet, you know, almost speechless. I've taken a few moments of silence in the past couple of days for all that pain and suffering at the hands of some angry idiot with access to too much lethal firepower. And I'm not sure how I can help besides to go donate blood. But when I thought about it a little more, I have done some things right that I thought were important. I raised two boys, now 24 and 21 years old, and I taught them to respect firearms and human life. For background, I grew up with some exposure to guns. I had a brother-in-law who taught me proper handling and use of a 45 caliber handgun at a target range in the country we used to go to. So I knew I wanted to take my sons to gun safety class when they were old enough, as teens on our farm in southeast Wisconsin. So we went to the local gun club and learned proper handling and use of shotguns and rifles, and we do things like shoot skeet and that kind of thing. My goal was I wanted to make sure their curiosity about guns was satisfied and that their skills with guns were strong. Most of all, I wanted them never to see a gun as a weapon of choice to solve a conflict or a problem. So I believe they firmly get it and would never do anything rash with a weapon of such power to solve any of their problems in life. And after I thought about this some more, I realized there's something else I might be able to do in just in terms of having a conversation. I wrote an unpublished essay many years ago about what I thought the founding fathers and constitutional framers were trying to accomplish with the Second Amendment. And this is coming from somebody who's read a lot of the founding documents. And so I think I've read enough to be pretty informed on it. So, you know, and the thing is, when you read this stuff, you realize that what was created in America to preserve liberty, justice, and equality, you know, was a system of laws. You know, so in other words, none of this is guaranteed or free or given attributes of any society, but they must be granted, preserved, and defended by a system of social agreements that we call law. So this fact, I think, is a fact. Some people may disagree, but I'm just going to throw it out there for discussion. Never in their wildest dreams did the founders and framers, when they crafted the Second Amendment, did they imagine the destructive killing force of guns that we have today. I mean, how could they, right? So I don't dispute that an American's right to protect him or herself and family is paramount and profound. And just a treasured right to protect oneself and one's family. But to ignore the exponential advance of technology in the past 225 years is to misunderstand what the framers were trying to accomplish. They wanted to give us basic rights that made common sense at the time with what they saw as technology and to preserve the, you know, to have that framework of the separation of powers, to make sure nobody could tread on you. But they weren't fortune tellers. So I think this is a fundamental question we need to ask. What would their common sense tell them now if they could see our world where a single person can steal the liberty of hundreds of other people in minutes with a magical weapon that they could never have imagined? One liberty conceived long ago in the age of the musket had a very different definition to the founders and framers. I think that would be the conclusion of most of them if they could see us today. And we already have many precedents of restricting the liberty of those with dangerous weapons. In my opinion, the deadliest weapon in American society is the automobile. We intensely and heavily regulate their manufacture, use, and access to them with volumes of laws. So why should other killing toys be any different? So I don't know if publishing this essay will prevent any tragedy in the future, but I just wanted to share the ideas. More importantly, in the aftermath of the tragedy, as so many families in Las Vegas and beyond are hurting terribly, I want to acknowledge all the police, fire, and medical personnel who helped and continue to help the victims. Las Vegas will never be the same, and those people on the front lines helping will never be the same either. So strength and peace to all of them. I'll be back in a moment with a tribute to the late, great Monty Hall and his wonderful probability brain buster. Do you know how to put the odds in your favor to win a car instead of a goat? It's trickier than you think, even when you think Monty is trying to trick or help you. Okay, so this past weekend, we lost Monty Hall at the ripe young age of 96, and he was the co-creator and host of Let's Make a Deal. Now, if you're not familiar with Let's Make a Deal, I'll try and give you a little background here, and I'm going to read some from the New York Times did a great obituary article on him by Dennis Hevesy. I will spell his name because I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, H-E-V-E-S-I. This is published on September 30th, and he opens talking about the sort of craziness of the show, because if you find an old clip or something, you'll see people in crazy costumes jumping up and down. But that wasn't exactly the way the show started. It sort of evolved to the crazy costumes. And when they talked to Monty Hall about, and I think this is like 1963, the show debuted, and they actually called the studio and stage audience area, they called it the trading floor. So that's kind of cool, because that's what Monty did. He made deals with people. And people, for the first few shows, came dressed like you would in the 1960s if you went to a game show, women in dresses, men in suit and ties, that kind of thing. But then they realized they had to get Monty's attention to get him to choose them to make a deal. So they started wearing crazy costumes and signs, and it just evolved from there. So let me read from the New York Times article here. It was all for the chance to barter their way to a big prize. A woman might sell Mr. Hall the contents of her handbag for $150. And then agree to trade that $150 for whatever was behind a curtain or in a big box in the hope that it was something valuable, say a $759 refrigerator freezer stocked with $25 worth of cottage cheese and a $479 sewing machine. She could then compound her glee by being smart enough not to trade it all back for the old purse and whatever amount of cash Mr. Hall had slipped into it, maybe a hefty amount or maybe a measly $27. If she went for the deal that turned out to be a loser, she was, in the language of the show, zonked. At the end of the show, the two biggest winners were given a shot at the big deal. They could trade their winnings for whatever was behind one of three doors, a new car, perhaps, or $15,000 in cash. Or, if they were not so lucky, something worth less than what they had traded. All the while, the affable, smooth-talking Mr. Hall gave no hint of where the treasure might lie. And this is a quote from David Schwartz, the author of the Encyclopedia of TV Game Shows. He was interviewed for this article, and he said, "Monty had to be a very likable con man. He had to convince people to give up a bird in the hand for what's in the box." Mr. Hall had other responsibilities too, Mr. Schwartz added. He had to be a traffic cop to get a decision out of the contestant without taking a long time. With his great ability to ad-lib, he knew how to keep the show moving. And I think they also reflected on, what a smooth salesman he was. What a great student of human behavior and knowing how to, get people to move along, make a deal, make a decision, and feel good about it one way or the other. So what is this probability brain buster that that I talk about. Well, I first learned of it from a 1992 book called The New Market Wizards. Jack Swagger chronicled some of the great traders of the 70s and 80s and 90s in his first book, Market Wizards, which I think was published in like 1989. You know, you got to read about some of the commodity traders of the 70s and 80s and some stock traders. And I was a clerk on the trading floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange in 1994, and luckily found those books and then got to read some of these stories. And what was great about what Swagger did is he basically interviewed these great traders, and there were some women too, but it was kind of a man's world, so the women who elbowed their way in really stood out too. So you're talking people who started trading soybeans and corn and then moved on to gold and T-bills and Japanese yen and then options. And options was an area of particular interest for me. I looked at people like Blair Hull, who created an options trading firm and sold it to Goldman Sachs in 1999 for about $500 million. It was called Hull Trading. But I got to meet Blair Hull, and one thing I knew about him is he was one of the original card counters in Vegas. He put himself through college going to Vegas and counting cards at the blackjack tables. And, you know, he had a system because he had read Ed Thorpe's book, Beat the Dealer. So I was just fascinated with that sort of applied probability. You know, you've got the finite discrete math, but then you've also got to sort of game the table and the players. And that's what I talked about last week in my video on Daniel Negreanu and using poker smarts to outsmart the stock market. So in the 1992 book, The New Market Wizards, Jack Swagger talked to another options pro named Jeff Yass. And I'm going to read a little bit from a Philly magazine article, phillymag.com, from August of 2009, because Yass is from Philadelphia and his trading firm was located just northwest of the city, I believe. This is how the article opens. Jeff Yass was always a little different from his peers, a brilliant young man taken with poker and horse racing and the power of rational decision making. He's used all of it to turn his company, Bala Cynwyd. I've never heard of it before. I guess it's a community, a suburb northwest of Philadelphia. Anyway, his firm is Susquehanna International. So very, big and important options trading firm globally, Susquehanna. I mean, he was friends with some people I worked for at Peak Six, which was another very important options trading firm here in Chicago. So he turns Susquehanna into one of the world's most lucrative and powerful financial firms. So let me read how this article begins, because this is what Yass is famous for, it inspired me to study probability and statistics, which I had to teach myself in my 30s, believe it or not, because I was not the greatest math student when I was in high school or college. Let's play a game. Let's say you're a contestant on Let's Make a Deal, Monty Hall's game show from a generation ago. It's your moment. There are three doors. Behind one door is a brand new Camaro. Behind each of the other doors, there's a goat. If you pick the right door, the Camaro is yours. Silky-voiced Monty Hall gives you the big question. Do you pick door number one, door number two, or door number three? The studio audience weighs in, and tension builds as you think. Finally, you pick, let's say, door number one. But Carol Merrill, Monty's assistant, doesn't open it yet. Instead, Monty Hall directs Carol to open one of the other doors. Door number two, say. Behind that door is a goat. The audience titters nervously. That Camaro, still hidden, might yet be yours. First, though, Monty is going to give you another choice. He's going to give you both an option and a dilemma. Would you like to stay with door number one, he asks, or would you like to switch to door number three? You ponder. But it's a no-brainer, right? With two doors left, there's a 50-50 chance the Camaro is behind either one. So you might as well stick with door number one, your first choice. Now I'm going to quote a man named Jeff Yass from a book called The New Market Wizards. These words have made him very rich. The correct answer is that you should always switch to door number three, or switch your choice. The probability that the prize is behind one of the doors you did not pick was originally 2/3. The fact that Monty opens one of those two doors and there is nothing behind it doesn't change this original probability, because he will always open the wrong door. In other words, Monty knows where the car is. He's going to show you one of the other doors that has a goat and then put you in that dilemma. That's what you didn't consider. Monty Hall knows exactly where that Camaro is parked, and he wasn't about to direct Carol to open that door, a door that revealed it. No, he's going to stretch out the game to have fun with you to see if, in your finger-crossed begging of the fates, you'll switch doors. And that's the thing. Your intuition is telling you, with two doors left, that the odds have got to be 50-50, but that's wrong. The door you picked originally had a 1/3 chance of yielding that Camaro. Monty Hall picking a door he knows doesn't hide the car won't make it more likely that your door does. All right, and the article goes back to Jeff Yass here. Therefore, if the probability of the prize being behind one of those other two doors was 2/3 originally, the probability of it being behind the unopened of those two doors must still be 2/3. So he's just reemphasizing that point. If you had a 1 in 3 chance of being right, and you had a 2/3 chance of being wrong, and now it's just been shown to you that one of those doors with the 2/3 chance, you know, holds a goat. So it means now there's one door that has a 2/3 probability, because it gets to keep that probability. It's this sort of, and this is the conclusion of the article here. If this sort of thing makes you cross-eyed, suffice it to say that an empire has been built in Bala Cynwyd by Jeff Yass, based not on numbers, but on a philosophy, a certain worldview. A world in which Monty Hall will always open the wrong door, so to speak. And then they talk a little bit more about Yass and what he did in college, and, you know, sort of a numbers-obsessed geek, and then built Susquehanna. And I just want to read this last paragraph from the Philly Magazine article. Yass learned to make utterly rational choices again and again and again and again in a game fraught with as much desire and crazy behavior and silliness, with as much raw emotion as a rabbit-wearing contestant on Let's Make a Deal. Well, that's how the author is trying to make the trading floor sound. But the thing about options trading is it's much more precise. Yes, there's yelling and screaming to get attention and be able to buy or sell. But there's a lot of precision with options trading, where the market makers learned that what they were actually doing was buying and selling volatility. And they didn't care the direction that a commodity or a stock went. They just wanted to be able to buy volatility low, relatively speaking, and sell it high. And that's a very mathematical game. That's Jeff Yass's brilliance. The world, according to Yass, runs on figuring out which door to open. While the rest of us might think we know the answer, he asks a question. The question is, what's Monty Hall thinking? Well, you know, and that's the beauty of that show and Monty Hall and what he did. He's, you know, he wasn't trying to trick anyone. He was just giving them that chance, you know, to, you know, basically choose their own destiny. And, you know, nobody understood the probability at the time. This actually became a debate in the newspapers, sort of a, you know, ask the Mensa person at some local newspaper. But it became such an important brain buster, because it could teach probability if you could learn to crack through it. So I'm assuming that a good, let's say, half of the audience right now listening to this probably still doesn't get the problem intuitively. It's still like going, well, wait a second, you know, how could I be so wrong about this? Or why should I switch? Why is switching always the answer? Well, it doesn't mean that every time you switch, you're going to win the car. You know, the car could be under your original pick, but over a lot of trials, like if you did this 100 times, you want to go with the mathematical probability. And this is the way some people play poker. This is what we talked about with in my video last week on Daniel Negreanu, is that what makes Negreanu unique is that he's not just playing the probability, because all good poker players, especially at the, you know, at the world tour level, they all know the math. They all know the probability. So when you watch them play poker, and we get to see the odds of every hand because we get to see all the hands. They, you know, they don't have that, so they've got to play on, well, what's possible, you know, based on, you know, what's shown on the table, what I have in my hand, that kind of thing. And a player like Phil Helmut, he just plays strictly the probability. But you know, Daniel Negreanu, he wants to play the person. He wants to get inside their head and maybe see if he can break their, you know, their stoic look and reveal what they have. And he's, you know, just a master at that. So let me help out here with by coming at the Monty Hall problem a couple different ways. Because if you can learn this, it's really kind of fun and makes you see the power of probability, at least in some cases. So one way to think about this is go through the scenarios where you could choose any door. You know, you've got A, B, C, or 1, 2, 3, however you want to look at. So let's say you choose a door and it does have the car behind it, but you don't know that yet, okay? So if you switch your choice, you know, after Monty opens one of the other two doors and it has a goat and you switch, you lose. Okay, so that's one scenario that could happen. Now, the next scenario is that you choose, let's say you choose A again, and then you're shown a goat. And let's say that the door you pick does have a goat behind it, but you don't know that yet. And then you're shown another door that has a goat. If you switch, you win the car. I mean, it's that simple. Okay, so now we've seen a scenario where if you stay with your choice, you win the car because the car was behind the door you picked. And then we've seen the scenario where if you switch, it works. So far, things are stacking up like 50-50. But the other scenario is you choose door B, and you're shown door A, which has a goat. And if you switch, you win. So we've just gone through the three possibilities, and in two of them, you win the car by switching. And in only one scenario do you win by staying. So if you lay out those scenarios and look at them on paper, it makes a lot of sense. And one place I recommend you do that is Dr. Math. Just go Google Dr. Math Monty Hall, and they give a great explanation of it. Another way to think about this is imagine that there's 100 doors, okay? So we've got 100 doors, so that means you have a 1 in 100 chance of picking the correct door on your first try, right? There's 100 doors, and only one door has the car. So you've got a 1 in 100 chance. Now, what is Monty Hall going to do in this scenario? He's going to open 98 doors and show you goats. 98 goats behind 98 doors. And he's leaving one door covered, which you don't know. Did you pick the car, or is the car behind that one? Well, if you think about it, you know, what was the original probability was that you were only correct with your door, 1 in 100 chance. And the possibility that it was behind another door was 99 out of 100. Well, now that 99 out of 100, 99% probability just got transferred to the one door that you're being offered to switch to. So you think about it that way, is what are the chances that you were going to be right? Only 1 in 100. So the odds are that it was in a different door. So you've just been given now the chance to switch to a single door that has the probability of 99% of having the car. So, I mean, you know, that's the heaviest way to express the logic of why you always switch in this case. So that's our fun probability brain buster, little tribute to Monty Hall, who just passed away, I believe, on September 30th. Now, we're going to close today with going back to Daniel Negreanu, who also did something fun over the weekend, although he took a break from even talking about it after the Vegas tragedy. Obviously, he's affected. He probably, you know, he spends a lot of time there, knows a lot of people there, and was impacted. So, but one thing that he started doing that I started following him on Twitter was putting up some quizzes for people who play poker. And what he would do is give them very limited information. Say, you know, he'd say, you know, here are three or four things, you know, in this particular hand, and then he'd give you choices. What are you going to do? Are you going to call, fold, raise, check, that kind of thing? And it was actually pretty funny I'm no expert poker player at all. So, I mean, even when I first read it, the shorthand for, you know, Let me see if I can find this one here. It was tough for me to grasp, so I had to go to my my poker expert friends and my son. My 24-year-old son plays quite a bit, and get the deal. I'll just read this to you real quick. So he posted this probably maybe Sunday morning, maybe Saturday night before the tragedy. Six max NLH. NLH, I believe, stands for No Limit Hold'em. It's a cash game, 100 big blinds, deep, no antes. All fold to you, meaning all players have folded. It's to you, but the big blind is still in. So you, and then he tells you what your hand is. You have queen two off suit. What is your play and why? And then he gives you these choices. Now, what I found amazing was all the poker players who put in the comments on Twitter, you know, things like, well, obviously, you know, I don't have enough information here. You know, what's this? You know, who's the big blind? How big are the stacks? You know, all these different things, you know, and what even I noticed is not a poker pro at all, is that people were second guessing. They wanted more information. And this connected with me in a big way, because I've told you before, about 15 years ago, I created a training for traders that was a probability simulation where I asked them to make risk-reward decisions and with very limited information. Like, I didn't even tell them what we were trading. I gave them a certain probability dynamic for what could unfold over 20 trades, and they had to make decisions every time. But people would get frustrated. Well, how can I do that? I need more information. But really, it was about testing their fundamental grasp of probability with very limited information, and then acting on that uncertainty. And so that was some fun that Daniel Negreanu is having with his quizzes here, where he finds that even active poker players object to, well, I can't decide. I need more information. I mean, what about this? What about that? So if you're into poker at all, make sure you follow him on Twitter and check out his new quizzes. And thanks for joining me once again in Mind Over Money. If you got questions about the Monty Hall problem, fire them my way. I'll send you some resources or anything else probability related. It's one of my favorite topics. I think that that everyone, you know, from age 10 to 100 could benefit from getting a better education in basic probability, because I mean, especially in this fantastic age of science, where we have to deal with so many problems, from disease to potential climate change, or just everyday statistics. We know that statistics can be misused. So learning how to read statistics and data is so important, because we're just going to keep getting inundated with more data as the Internet of Things continues to collect massive amounts of data, and Google and Amazon and Microsoft and Alibaba and many of my favorite companies continue to provide it to us, or NVIDIA for that matter. By the way, little competitor to NVIDIA, Advanced Micro, AMD is the stock symbol there, just announced a new GPU chip today. A new GPU chip platform. That's the graphics processing units, the parallel processing. And, so they're starting to do some exciting things in their ability to compete with NVIDIA in all those spaces where you need advanced computing and the potential of artificial intelligence and that sort of thing. All right, Kevin Cook, your probability coach, over and out. Talk to you next week.